welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. I am Tom Garcia, your host for this next hour on the American Hour, and we're located on the USA Talk Radio Network. And you can go to usatalkradionetwork.com to find us and listen to us. You can also listen to us over the phone. If you want to dial in to the phone, let me get the number here because it just recently changed. It is 310-982-4145, so you can listen just over your phone if you needed to, and you can also call in and say that you'd like to participate in the show. So if you're interested in participating in the show, please call on in, and we will talk a little bit later on. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on lately. I broadcast that this show is going to be talking about the Constitution a little bit in terms of current events and things going on in Libya and the military. So let's talk about Libya. First of all, what is the purpose of a no-fly zone? Well, a no-fly zone is meant to stop bad guy airplanes from flying. So in the case of Libya, we did have bad guy airplanes flying and doing things to the civilians there that really weren't too nice. So what is the best way to establish a no-fly zone? Well, what we saw happen a week or so ago was that we flew in and took out the defenses, as many as we could, so that we could start flying our aircraft, and the French and the Brits and other folks could fly their aircraft in support of stopping the bad guy aircraft, the Libyan aircraft, from killing people. But then we also started dropping bombs and some other things. So it really wasn't just a no-fly zone. And no-fly zone has sort of a connotation of, we're just going to fly around and flex our muscles so that nobody wants to fly around here and do bad things. Well, the good news is it worked. The bad news is if you really want to enforce a no-fly zone, the easiest way to do that is to take out the airplanes so they can't fly. So let's analyze what happened in Libya. By the time we started to enforce our no-fly zone, of the 13 air bases that exist in Libya, there are three major air bases. The other 10 air bases had been overrun by the rebels. So there was just the three major air bases out to the west, not to the east near Tripoli and the other major cities where they've got lots of air defenses and where we did all of the fighting with our jets. So what we could have done and what we should have done and would have been much less costly would have been to just go blow up those three major bases where all the airplanes were flying out. That would have been a very simple solution and would have cost us a lot less money than the supposed $500 million, now approaching $1 billion, that we spent. See, when you take out their air bases and you take out their airplanes, you don't need a no-fly zone because there's nothing to fly. It's pretty simple. But we didn't do that. What we did was we took the political and costly way of managing the situation, and we also risked our pilots' lives. And this is one of the problems I have when we go into different conflicts like this, is the way we make decisions based on what's politically most expedient and makes us look the best or whatever you want to say about it. And then we risk our soldiers and sailors and aviators' lives to do something that is not very smart. We could have taken out those two bases in about 2 days. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, how does this guy even know what he's talking about? Well, I was a fighter pilot in the Navy. In the last, actually a couple years before I retired, I was the executive officer of a war game facility, not the active duty, but the reserve facility in San Diego, Point Loma, San Diego. So I know a little something about this, and as we first started talking about no-fly zones, I saw a lot of misinformation going out over the radio. So that's all kind of ancient history now, but I just wanted to let people know that the way we handled that was not very good, very expensive, and that's what I said before we even initiated. I said, if we do what they're talking about, it's going to be very, very expensive. All we really need to do are take out his three major air bases. And at that time, the rebels had not overrun the other bases, but those were minor bases and bases that he really wouldn't be able to operate out of. And we've proven all of that at this point. So in any case, things worked out, but they cost us a lot of money. And once again, the federal government spends our money like there's no tomorrow. All right. Now, what else about Libya? What else about Libya that's going on? Well, let's look back at just the beginning of the whole incident and our involvement in it. We talked about, the president having the constitutional authority to go in there and do that. And in the Constitution, he doesn't really have the authority. Of course, there's nothing that says he can't, but we know that the Constitution says you can only do what the Constitution says. Now, there was what the media has been calling a War Powers Act, and that's incorrect because it's not a War Powers Act. It is a War Powers Resolution that was passed after the Vietnam War so that we wouldn't be getting ourselves into more undeclared wars like Korea and Vietnam. And the media has been accurately representing the War Powers Resolution as a resolution that gives the Commander-in-Chief the authority to send troops into a fighting situation, and he has 60 days to do that. If Congress doesn't act, he's got another 30 days, but then that's it. So he's got a total of 90 days if Congress doesn't act. And do we expect in this day and age that Congress can act in a 60-day period or a 90-day period? Probably not. So he's probably got 90 days. The thing the media has been leaving out is there's a condition. There's actually three conditions. The only time the president can use this authority to go in anywhere he wants with our troops are under three conditions. And guess what they are? The number one condition is there's been a declaration of war. Let's see, that would mean Congress acted. Yeah. Okay, that didn't happen. The second is that he has specific authority from the Congress. Did he get specific authority? He said he chatted with a few congressmen and a few senators. So no, he wasn't given authority. What this means is Congress does not have to declare war. And we didn't do that when we went in Iraqi freedom. We didn't declare war. We just authorized the president to take action. So that was all legal, but we didn't have that. And the final piece of authority to work, to operate under the War Powers Resolution is that the president must feel or believe that United States citizens, the U.S. itself, is under attack or will be attacked in imminent danger, and that's really the term they use, imminent danger to the United States of America and or its territories. So let's see. Nah, that wasn't the case either. So I really don't know under what authority the president acted, but it wasn't any enumerated power, either in the Constitution or the War Powers Resolution that was passed in the, I believe it was the 70s. So in any case, that's a little bit on Libya and what's been going on there. Now, I was on the radio this morning with the Dave Scott Show out in Las Vegas, and we had a nice conversation. Dave is a fiscally conservative person. He calls himself an independent, but he's pretty liberal on social issues. And during our conversation, we had, there was an interesting time that we were talking about the role of the federal government and its ability to do things for us. And, you know, most liberals believe that that's a good thing and we should let the federal government do just as much as possible for us. But the problem with that is the federal government was never designed to do that. And I'm going to give you a few quotes from our founders here in a moment so that we can, you know, discuss that. But what he said was, and I thought this was interesting, and I've heard it before, is that if the states, and I said really the states, and let me back up, the states have the authority to do some of these things, and that's who should be handling these issues. And I'll read you the quote, and it's I consider it indisputable. But he said, what if the states are failing? Somebody's got to step in. Somebody's got to do something. And that is really the mindset of the liberal, is that somebody's got to do something. And the fact is, nobody has to do anything. Nobody has to do anything. The reality is that liberals want somebody to do something, but it does not mean somebody has to do something. So, and I don't necessarily disagree on certain social issues, but let's just say you, whoever you might be out there in radio land, says, I really think the government needs to step in and do this, the federal government. And then I say, but I don't think they do. It's just opinion versus opinion. And so it's who's right, who's wrong. We have to default to the law of the land. If we start allowing the federal government to do things it doesn't have authority to do, then we're going to run into those problems. So let's take a look at what our founders had to say. And we've got one caller on the line waiting. It looks like from maybe up in the Port Orange or New Smyrna Beach area. I will get to you in just a moment. But let's see what Thomas Jefferson had to say about the federal government. He said, let the national government be entrusted with the defense of the nation and its foreign and federal relations. The state governments with the civil rights, laws, police, and administration of what concerns the state generally. Oh, okay, that makes sense. Now, people could argue with Thomas Jefferson, but the fact is this. He was there when they were doing this. He was there when his friend James Madison wrote, drafted the initial draft of the Constitution. He was there and wrote the Declaration of Independence. So let's see what Madison had to say, the gentleman who drafted. Now, there were other drafts for the Constitution. We had our Constitutional Congress. There were other drafts, such as the British draft. That was Alexander Hamilton's draft. It was called, I believe, the British draft because it was modeled more after the government in Great Britain at the time, without a king, of course, but more after the centralized government in Great Britain. The proposal that Madison wrote was called the Virginia Plan. Virginia had a lot of political pull back then, and that's probably why his was adopted. But here we go. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The former will be exercised principally on external objects, as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives and liberties and properties of the people, and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. So there's the problem. We've become a culture, a society, a nation, where we have asked our federal government to do more than it was ever intended to and ever structured to do, and that's why it keeps failing at it. And the states have given that power up. Ben Franklin predicted all of that this would happen. So how do we get back? Well, that's really the key. We've got to shrink the size of the federal government and return more power to the states. Now, as my friend today, Dave Scott, said, but what if the states don't do a good job? Guess what? It's just too bad. We as citizens are in much greater control of our state legislatures, which are made up of what? Part-time politicians. That's a part-time job. They don't get paid a lot. They still work their other jobs in many cases. So we have much more control over our state legislatures, and that's where social and civil issues should be handled, and that's where we need to go. All right, let's take a caller now. I'm going to see who this is. Like I said, I think it's probably somebody from New Smyrna or possibly can you hear me? Hello? You're on the Tom. Let me bring you on there. Let's see. Well, that's what I get for using the system. I'm having trouble figuring out how to use this. I'm sorry, caller. I'll get to you in just a second once I figure this whole thing out. Here we go. Now you're on air. All right. I pushed the right button. Boy, it's tough when you don't have a call screener working for you. So who am I talking to?
You're talking to Dick in Port Orange.
Dick Berenbeck. Oh, I didn't recognize the number. I looked on my phone, and for some reason it wasn't either of the numbers that I had. Oh, it is. It's your home number. All right. Well, welcome, Dick Berenbeck, good friend of mine, a career law enforcement officer and all-around great patriot. How are you doing today, Dick?
Hey, let's not forget 5 years attached to the FBI. I was proud of that.
That's right. You were 5 years, and you've got some great stories. Boy, I love when you tell stories about some of the different kooky things that happened when you were working with the FBI as well as a police officer. Now, I don't want to embarrass you, but I want to let people know because you're a good friend of mine. Dick recently suffered a heart attack. Now, you have to understand that Dick is a big, burly, strong, tough guy. Even though, you know, he's been retired for some years, he still looks like he could jump out there and chase down a criminal and take on the tough guys. But from what we talked about the other day, it sounded like, boy, this thing really wiped you out, and you just feel really, really weak. Is that true?
It is. It left me with no interest in anything at the present moment, no energy to do anything. And probably part of that was I only spent 3 days in the hospital before he discharged me, which is the shortest I've ever been in a hospital for a heart problem.
Yeah.
And it might have been just a little bit too soon to let me out.
You're right. But, you know, the thing that always scares me is staying in the hospital too long. There's a lot of bad little things running around the hospital. And in fact, my grandfather, who had a heart attack, he was a bit older than you, and this was some years ago, he was admitted to the hospital, and he was doing okay, and they said to my grandmother, you can take him home. And she said, well, let's leave him another night, and he caught pneumonia, and he died from that. He didn't die from the heart attack. He died from pneumonia. So I'm glad you're home, and you're at least doing okay.
Well, thank you.
Feeling better.
Let me give you a very short story about hospital stays.
Okay.
As you know, I had quadruple bypass surgery quite a few years ago.
Right.
And after the surgery, you go through therapy where you exercise and get your heart back up to where it belongs. And the doctor had come in on Wednesday and said, or on Tuesday, and said, I'm going to let you go home on Thursday. And I said, okay. He came in on Thursday and said, no, you're not doing good enough. I'm going to keep you over the weekend. I said, I'm going home on Friday. He said, I don't think so, Dick. I went into therapy and outdid what they thought I could do, and he came back in and said, I guess you want to go home. You're out of here.
Okay. Well, yeah, I know. It's one of those tough calls. But in any case, I know that we talked the other night. When we talked the other night, I said, what is the thing that concerns you most about our country, our government right now? And you remember what your answer was?
I don't recall.
You said the debt. And the national debt. And I've got to tell you that back when I was campaigning in this last election cycle, which I'll let everybody know, that's the past. I'm not doing any campaigning at all now, or I don't anticipate anything in the future. We're just going to have fun with the radio show. But I was out a lot and talking with a lot of people, and I saw things sort of change over the course of that 2008 to 2010 election cycle, where more and more people were talking about not necessarily the economy and jobs, because that was the big concern around 2008. It started becoming the debt, and people were very, very concerned about our national debt, our annual deficit, and our growing national debt. And I agree with you. When you say something like that, I think it's a big concern for people, whereas a few years ago people were concerned about, boy, I hope I don't lose my job, or I need to find a job, and that's important. But, boy, if the whole system collapses, then nobody's got a job. And that's just a big, huge problem, and that's something to be concerned about.
Well, right now, I think we've got a bigger problem than that, and something else that really scares me to death.
Uh-huh.
The work I've been doing, I did my time in the service like you did, Tom. I didn't spend as much time, but then I did my time with the police department and the FBI. I'm not afraid to get in and mix it up. A number of years back, and a lot of our young adults today don't know this or remember, there was a young Marine lieutenant that was called in front of Congress because of the federal money he was spending on his personal home security. And he told them at the time, yes, I'm scared, and you better be scared too. I'm scared of Bin Laden. And they laughed and said, who in the heck is that?
Yeah.
Well, now they all know who Bin Laden is. That was Lieutenant Kelly of the United States Marine Corps.
Okay.
Now, you look back at the majority of the Arab dictators, Gaddafi, all of them. We have supported them in the past, both with military supplies and money. Matter of fact, at the time that Lieutenant Kelly was scared to death of Bin Laden because Bin Laden had threatened his family and him, we were supporting Bin Laden fighting the Russians. And I don't know if our government is that stupid or if they don't want to tell us what's going on. There's a lot of fighting going on right now in all the Arab nations. And the poor citizens of this country are being told they're fighting for democracy. I'm sorry, it's not a democracy like we know. Fighting the dictators is the Taliban and the Brotherhood. And unfortunately, if they win and take the dictators out through our help, they will go after Israel. And after Israel, They will come after us if they don't come after us at the same time. And that's what scares me. Them walking down our streets, walking into our stores with their body bombs, parking a car right outside of a store, blowing it to smithereens. And
well,
unfortunately,
you're right.
We've got a president that already said he is Muslim. I don't think he will go against the Muslim nation to support Israel. And that is sad.
Well, he's already made it clear he's not too much of a fan of Israel, but he doesn't have the final say on that, so that's the good news. But I think we'll be I think we can handle that. And of course, yeah, our goal is to get rid of a weak commander in chief in the next presidential election, and that's what a lot of people are going to be working to do. Let's see if it's time to take a quick little commercial break here. If you hang, can you hang on the line? We've got another call. I'm going to bring somebody on. There, it looks like they're calling from Ohio, and we'll just all have a party on the air here. But if you can, you stay on for a little bit longer, Dick?
I can hold on, Tom. Sure.
Okay. We're going to take a break here for a commercial break, and then we'll be right back. It's just a short commercial break.
National Veterans Homeless Support, or NVHS, was formed by veterans for the sole purpose of locating and assisting the more than 4,500 homeless veterans living in the parks, forests, and streets of Central Florida. Their mission is clearly defined, to eliminate homelessness among veterans in Central Florida, and they work very hard to accomplish this mission. They offer a very unique service to the community in that they are the only organization that goes out into the field, searching for the veterans, providing supplies where they find them, and working with other organizations to get them out of the woods and back into society. If you go to their website, it's located at nvhs.us, and you can also find them on Facebook. Their Veterans Resources link on their webpage is worth its weight in gold, so please go check out the website, and if you're able, make a donation. They do a very, very valuable service to the veterans of Central Florida, and we'd like to expand this and see it expand to the rest of the country.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.
All right, we're back. I told you that was going to be a short break. Let's see. We've got somebody from Ohio who, it looks like Ohio, who called in. Is that where you're calling from, sir, Ohio?
Yes, Columbus, Ohio. My name is Rick. I'm 26 years old. I'm glad you left Dick on the line because I'm really interested in catching both of your guys' perspective, being that you're from the older generation, and I think this younger generation and the older generation really need to connect on these issues and come together and really figure it out rather than playing the blame game. You know, a lot of people my age want to say, like, well, the baby boomers are the ones who screwed it up for us, and I'm not saying that's exactly right or exactly wrong, but I think we need to get together regardless of age and get like-minded individuals to get in there and fix these problems.
Well, I like your attitude, and I got to tell you, we are to blame. My generation has been asleep at the wheel for too long. That's why I got off the couch a few years ago and got involved, and we are doing you a disservice, and we'd better get our act together right now so that the younger generation doesn't pay for our sins. But I appreciate your attitude on wanting to try and work things out, and you certainly do have a vested interest in that. But here, I'll let you have it back, and go ahead and talk about whatever you want.
Okay. I like where Dick was going with the conversation, and I try to stay out of conspiracy theory, but we're really concerned with the debt, and we're really concerned with the way that our politicians seem to be just doing their own thing, regardless of what we say or what they said they were going to do. And we know we're at a place to where we very well could fail economically, that hyperinflation could kick in if people stop backing the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency and start flooding their treasuries onto the market. We are done as far as the U.S. greenback goes. With the climate in the Middle East and the way the debt is going, you know, I start to draw these correlations. Now, I'm not an Alex Jones fan. I think he's egotistical and profit-minded. And there's a lot of crazy conspiracies out there that I don't buy into. But I want to know your guys' perspective of an older generation. Do you believe that there could be a force such as the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations? Do you think there could be a force within these groups that are trying to shut this country down so they can bring in things like the Amero or a one-world currency like the Russian Prime Minister debuted at the G8 summit? What are your thoughts on that, that they could be crashing this thing by design? They can't be that stupid to do the things that they're doing. Everybody looks and goes, well, that's stupid, but they do them anyway. So what do you feel about maybe a shadowy type situation playing in our government?
Well, you want to take that, Dick?
I can't talk that much about the trilateral. We are letting the United Nations, if you go back in time and look at why the United Nations was formed and what their purpose was, at the present time, the United Nations is trying to take over the world, have a one-world government. And
absolutely.
What bothers me is if the Taliban gets strong enough, that one-world government will be the Taliban. You won't pray at your church. You'll do what they tell you. You'll work where they tell you. It will make Hitler look like a walk in the park. I don't know who's all behind it. I'm not into some of that stuff like I should be. I've been working more with our local governments and our federal governments trying to get our politicians straightened out. Yes, there is something going on that we are not privy to, at least not me.
Well,
I agree 100%. And how do you feel? Like I said, I don't agree 100% with all these conspiracy theories, but I check them out because I think they're closer to the truth than what they tell us. But how do you feel about the events surrounding September 11th? Like Building 7, not even hit by a plane, crashes into its own footprint in a matter of 6 seconds, and then they tell us, it was on fire. It was only 25 years old. I have a hard time believing that fire code would permit a situation like that. It didn't even have jet fuel involved in the fire, but it collapsed in its own footprint in 6 seconds. They got to be not telling us something. Nobody talks about how Osama bin Laden worked with the CIA, in the Afghani war. You know, like you said, he was fighting against the Russians. Two of the hijackers were actually living at the time with a CIA informant in an apartment. They're not telling us something.
Well, here's my take on this.
Let me tell you something about law enforcement, and I'm sure the FBI and the CIA work the same way. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to play games with the bad guys to get the real bad guys. In other words, you may not want the small marijuana dealer that sells a couple of cigarettes here and there. You want his supplier. You want that supplier's supplier.
Yeah, I
can
understand
that. The
CIA
could have been working with them people looking for bigger fish, knowing who they were, but didn't know the plans that they had. Now, what scares me?
Now,
I'm in Florida, and the university where they learned how to fly, I can spit and hit the buildings almost. What scares me is these people went to that school. They didn't want to know how to land a plane or how to take off with a plane. They wanted to know how to fly it. Now, how many people are going to go to an aeronautical school and say, I don't care about landing, I don't care about takeoffs, just teach me how to fly it? Shouldn't a red light go off?
Yeah, red lights, no, here's the problem with that, Dick. Red lights don't go off because people just want to fly. I mean, I know obviously something about aviation, and I've seen...
I hope you do, Tom.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I actually learned how to land an airplane, but I didn't learn how to take one off, so I have to use the autopilot for that. No, I'm just kidding. But
you didn't have much choice. You had OSHA underneath you.
Yeah. I see in the aviation industry so many ups and downs, and I mean, that's, yeah, I'm not trying to be funny. The industry, it's constantly, you know, either running, the river's running full or it's dry. And so when somebody comes along and says, yeah, I want to pay you money on the spot here to learn how to fly around an airplane, you take their money. That's just the way it is. Now, there should have been some red flags, but our government doesn't do a very good job of monitoring and keeping track of things like aviation. They say they do. We pay them a lot of money, like, for example, the FAA, and there are some things they do very well. I'll tell you, the NTSB, that's an organization that does very, very well. And if you look back years, you'll see recommendations repeated year after year after year coming out of the NTSB to the FAA to take action on certain things, and the FAA doesn't. So we got one organization that gets it but doesn't have control to make it happen, and the organization that has the control just doesn't get it done. And so to go back to your original question, Mr. Ohio, for about you know, why we are allowing some of this stuff or why this occurs, is there a conspiracy? I think there's, to some degree, not really any kind of conspiracy, but it's really just a comedy of errors where we are incompetent in various agencies within our government, and the terrorists are just very, very persistent and just keep pushing and pushing until they finally get through. I don't believe that there was any kind of conspiracy whatsoever in 9/11. I had friends that actually died on the Boston flight, Flight 11. And I had been flying out of Boston myself just prior to that. I just left Boston a few months earlier to fly out of Miami, where I now fly ever since there. And I really don't believe there's any kind of conspiracy there. Now, on a worldwide level, to bring our country down, I don't know that I would call it a conspiracy, but I do think that any time somebody has an opportunity or chance to knock us down a peg, they're going to do it and take advantage of us, because there's a lot of envy there. I travel all over the world, and I didn't spend a lot of time introducing myself at the beginning of the show, but I'm a commercial airline pilot, have been one for 19 years. I travel around the world in the Navy as a fighter pilot, and I see people that not only envy us, but many of them in those countries will come up to me, and or they find out that I'm from the U.S., they'll say, boy, you're so lucky. I'm trying to get to the United States. Or, now here's the other one. And this, I think, is a very interesting one. I run into people in South America that speak pretty good English, and I speak Spanish, but they want to use their English because they used to live in the States. They might have been in the States two or three, and they want to use their English. And I find out from them that they're quite happy in the States, really like the States, and almost miss it. It's just that their family and everybody else is in Brazil or Chile or wherever it is, and that's why they went back. And maybe that because of their family being there and having been there, you know, for generations, there are job opportunities for them. It's hard to tell, especially when they're young people. I know that a lot of young people tend to stay around in the area that they were raised in, even though they may, you know, go to college and get their own place, but they tend to stay around not too far from their family. So there is that envy out there, but there's also an admiration. But the governments, the powers that be, would love to see us taken down and will actively work on it. Now, think about China, for example. Wouldn't China love that the standard, the currency standard, their standard, based on their currency? They'd love that. So what kind of deals do you think they've been swinging and working with people to that end? It's a huge chess game, is what it is. And there are lots of dupes in the middle. Don't really know what's going on, but they're a part of the game. They're being manipulated and maneuvered by a few countries and organizations, et cetera. I wouldn't call it a conspiracy. I would just call it a big, complicated chess game. I don't know if that answers your question. I just see stupid things. Yeah, they're coincidental, but they certainly weren't conspiracy. But there have been some conspiracies along the way, and it can happen because I think ups and politicians, we see politicians over the years. One of my heroes when I was younger was Randy Cunningham. He was a Navy fighter ace in Vietnam, And then he became a congressman. I'll tell you what, we loved him. And I was still out there. I might have been in the reserves at this point when he got elected for his first term. And but we loved, the people loved him. He was great. And you saw what happened, how corrupt he got. And he knew in the end. He didn't try weaseling out of it. He took his lumps and went. So I think this kind of stuff corrupts, and it's very, very difficult for even good people to stay on the straight and narrow. And so that's why, one of the reasons, a smaller federal government ends up benefiting us, because there's just less room for error and less room for corruption.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And, so basically, you take, it's not a conspiracy. It's just kind of how the way the world works. And, of course, we're not privy to the information because we're just peons, and we couldn't handle how the world really works with, you know, backhanded deals.
Well, we could handle it, but they – yeah, I think we could handle it. They just don't want us to know. They just don't want us to know.
Yeah, because we wouldn't put up with it being a moral country. I'd say ultimately – our morals have become very askew, but I'd say ultimately, you know, the backbone of this country is moral – not that I'm affiliated with any religion, but moral Christian values, at least, as I'd like to think, that's still out there. And I don't think we would put up with a lot of stuff that we if we knew what was going on with false flag operations and such. And as you know, we put these dictators. I like to think that we almost farm these dictators. We put them in the power. We know they'll be screwing up in 25 years, and then we can come in and. Help them get a democracy, because we set up a little government that benefits our country, so we know we put the guys in the place that's going to play ball with us.
Well, I'll tell you my perspective on it. I think, really, quite honestly, our politicians look at things as sort of a live for today, for tomorrow never comes. They want to look good today, they want to get reelected, and we'll sort things out later on, wolf them later on. I've seen at the state level here in Florida now a lot of things happen that make no sense and for the long term are bad for the people of Florida. But in the short term, may make that politician look good, may create some jobs, and that's all they care about. And they'll come up with a new excuse or answer in the next election, and the next election after that, and the next one after that. And so when I was on the Dave Scott radio show this morning, he mentioned that the Republicans plan to cut, what was it, to reform Social Security. I believe that's what he said, Social Security. So the information we're getting now is it's going to be that we're going to have it completely privatized by, maybe it was Medicare, so it was one or the other, completely privatized by 2021. Now, he asked me, Tom, do you think that it would really take that long? It's such a good plan. Why can't we implement it right away? And I said, you know what? It may be a great plan, but no way, because if there are problems, it makes them look bad, and it's hard to get reelected. I guarantee you, politicians out there will disagree. No, Tom, no, we're not smart. I want to get it right. I'm telling you, this is my belief, and I think it's the right answer. If they spread it out and it actually works out, then they'll be a hero forever. If it doesn't work out, they can always say, oh, but it got off track, it got derailed, I had it on track. But they're not going to still be around in, you know, in what, 11 years from now, 12 years from now? No, they're not going to be around, most of them. And so they don't care. Well, I say they don't care. They care, but they're too concerned about getting reelected to And I'll even tell you, I've run into politicians that will justify it this way. They'll say, listen, I'm just starting to get some seniority in the system, and there's a lot of good things I can do. There are a lot of good things. I need a few more terms so I can get those things. I see all the freshman congressmen every single time, new people every single time. That's not exactly true. You know, we've got a little bit of experience, but It's out of control, I think, the politicians that are there for 20 to 30 years. They lose perspective. And one of the things I did in my career in the Navy was I analyzed the organizational culture of various organizations within the military. And so I got to become very good. I consider myself a subject matter expert on corporate and organizational culture. And I can tell you, this is just 101, culture 101. you stay in the same job, doing the same things for 20 years, you lose touch a lot longer than 20 years, probably in about 5 to 6 years, you will lose touch with actual reality.
Reality.
Now, I say now, you stop seeing the forest from the trees, you're not in touch with the people that you're supposed to be representing, and on and on and on. And we see that. And here we are.
That brings us down to term limits, Tom.
That's exactly why I support term limits. Exactly why. Because just the culture and nature of being in an organization that long. Now, you think back to when you were in the military, Dick, you're constantly changing jobs. Not only was I changing, going from one squadron to the next every 2.5 to 3 years, but within that squadron, I never had one single job for more than 6 months. And because they don't want you to get complacent and comfortable with your job. They want you always aggressively chasing after making that job and that department better.
Can I throw 2 minutes or 2 seconds in on what I've seen in a change in our country?
Go right ahead.
I was born in 43 and, of course, grew up in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. We had a lot different country back then. In the 60s, we changed. In the 60s, everything became permissible. Free society. Let everybody do their own thing. The flower power, the love child, etc., etc. Everybody has a right to do their own thing. I'm sorry, they don't. 90% of the people in this country today don't know what their rights are. And I see an awful lot of liberalism, if you want to use a word, letting people do their own thing, and it's hurting us. It's hurting us bad.
Yeah,
we see children raising a Mexican flag at a school, and it's okay.
Yeah.
We see a child wearing an American flag on his shirt at school during Cinco de Mayo, and he's sent home because we might offend the Mexicans. Excuse me, this isn't Mexico. If you're offended, leave. Everybody has a right to be here if they want to live by our rules. But don't turn me into a Mexico, a Muslim nation, or anything else. I'm an American.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think what you're really getting at there, Dick, is the political correctness that has gone overboard. And I absolutely believe liberty and freedom, but political correctness impedes on my individual liberty. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, listen, I'm going to take one more break here. You guys can stay on if you want. When we come back, we'll talk some more about this stuff. And if not, young man from Ohio, what was your name again?
Rick.
Rick, okay, Rick. Hey, Rick, call back anytime you want. Thanks for calling in the show. And, again, stick around till the end.
I'm going to have to go, Tom. Rick, it's been nice talking to you.
Yeah, thanks
a
lot.
Thanks for calling in. Take care of yourself.
Yep,
you
I'm going to stick on the
Thank
line
you,
and listen to the rest of the show.
Okay,
great. Great, Rick. All right, we're going to go to a quick commercial break here, and we'll be right back.
National Veterans Homeless Support, or NVHS, was formed by veterans for the sole purpose of locating and assisting the more than 4,500 homeless veterans living in the parks, forests, and streets of Central Florida. Their mission is clearly defined, to eliminate homelessness among veterans in Central Florida, and they work very hard to accomplish this mission. They offer a very unique service to the community in that they are the only organization that goes out into the field searching for the veterans, providing supplies where they find them, and working with other organizations to get them out of the woods and back into society. If you go to their website, it's located at nvhs.us, and you can also find them on Facebook. Their Veterans Resources link on their webpage is worth its weight in gold, so please go check out the website, and if you're able, make a donation. They do a very, very valuable service to the veterans of Central Florida, and we'd like...
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening in. We've got Rick still on the phone with us. I just want to make a quick mention about the NVHS. I played a couple ads for them. The National Veterans Homeless Support is a group that is doing fantastic work in the Central Florida area. Now, that's where they're doing their thing. But George Taylor, the founder of that group, and I have talked about this many times, would like to establish a model for which other groups across the country can start doing the same thing that the NVHS is doing. Now, one of the groups that NVHS is partnered with, and you can go look on their website and see who their sponsors are. Got some fantastic people like the local hospital system and some other groups that have done a lot to help them out, from a really grassroots organization to they're really building up a Class A organization, but they've always done great work. But the Bridges organization, it's actually the Bridges BTR, I think is what they're called, is what they originally were, and it was a transition facility for handicapped kids, mostly handicapped mentally, some physically, some combination. But it was parents back in 1956 that wanted to give their kids a place to go where they could get some form of education and training and maybe get into society. In 56, as you can imagine, the standard thought on handling kids like this was just to institutionalize them. And the parents, God bless them, of Rockledge, Florida, decided, no, we're not going to do that. So Bridges has been around ever since with sponsors, charitable donations, and parents participating in the process. And the reason I got to know about Bridges is because they got involved with the NVHS in putting together a veterans transition home. And they applied for a grant to help pay for that a couple years ago and didn't get it the first time. The second time they did, and I did what I could as a retired Navy commander and veteran to get them some help. I wasn't a whole lot of help. I did connect them with a few people just to make sure that they hadn't submitted any errors on their grant, and I'm tickled pink about it. They got the grant. So they've gotten some help from local folks in fixing up the home. They had already been using it as a transition home, but now it's going to be for disabled vets. And now we're talking vets in wheelchair, hurt in any kind of way. It's now a wheelchair-capable facility, the home, and it's in a nice neighborhood. And they've worked carefully with the neighbors to assure them of the kind of people that are going to be in there, and so the neighbors are actually okay with it. In any case, some great work going on, and if we can continue this sort of growth in this endeavor in Central Florida, I certainly believe and hope in my heart that this is something we can create in other states across the country, because our vets do suffer. And sometimes it's just a matter of they went into the military not really prepared for life. The military gave them something, and they got out, and now they don't have that military as a backdrop anymore, and they never really learned how to take care of themselves in life, and maybe they weren't doing so good to begin with. So there are a lot of reasons. I also see vets as an example. There was one vet we had, a young guy who came back from Iraq, and he got out of the military. He then started going to the community college, Brevard Community College, and he couldn't afford a place to stay. He couldn't even afford to share an apartment with somebody. So he was living in a tent, and he was living in a tent out in the woods behind where he worked, and he worked at a place where he cut hair. So, but he was really working hard and trying to do his best to get ahead. And those are the kind of people that the NVHS actively seek out, and help out. So please go to NVHS.org, check them out, see what you think, and let me know. In fact, in a future show, call in and tell me what you think. All right, Rick, what else you want to talk about? What other thoughts or ideas do you have about what's going on today in the world? I'm sorry, Rick. Start over. I didn't put you back on the speaker. My fault. Go ahead, Rick.
That's all right. Pretty much the only thing I ever want to talk about when I call into these shows is we agree that we're all screwed, regardless of why or who or where. What the heck are we going to do about it? I personally don't have many answers. I think term limits are one of them. I think drastically reducing the size of government. We have so much waste and surplus. I mean, we have duplicate bases across the world that don't even get used. They get built and they don't get used. If we can cut spending, you'll never get out of debt by spending more money. So no matter what piece of legislation you pass, every time a piece of paper crosses the president's desk, that means money. So what the heck are we going to do about it? How are we going to shrink this government to the point where they quit throwing our dollars out the window?
Well, I'll give you a good answer. Will it ever happen? I don't know. If I were king, then it would happen, absolutely. But first of all, let me ask you this. If we completely eliminated the Department of Interior, do you think there would be rioting in the streets and people protesting and going on TV and just threatening our elected officials if we completely eliminated the Department of Interior? What's your feeling?
Unfortunately, in this country, I don't think we could have any kind of even minor catastrophe type event without people running to the streets and looting. It's so ingrained in our nature as Americans to capitalize and take advantage. So I don't know what would come of that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'll tell you what will happen. First of all, most people don't even know what the Department of Interior does, and they don't really care. So there's a $15 billion budget that does us nothing. Department of Energy, $26 billion. What does it do for us? I can't find a person on the street that can tell me what the Department of Energy does for us, and I can tell you our return on investment is almost nil. So there's some of the problem. So let me throw some numbers out here. We spend about $1.3 trillion on Medicare and Social Security. Seems like a lot, right? As part of the budget. Then, of course, the military comes in, and, of course, we have debt. All right. How much do you think we spend on the federal government in terms of discretionary spending and non-mandatory spending?
It's a grotesque number. I'd say into the trillions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, the media always says discretionary spending is only $400 billion. It's the entitlement programs that are killing us. Well, they're wrong. Because they're not including all of the non-mandatory, which is the wasteful military, wasteful non-defense spending that we do. That's why it's called non-mandatory. Mandatory is we absolutely have to have this for the military, we absolutely have to have this for Social Security, absolutely have to have it for Medicare and Medicaid. It adds up to $1.3 trillion. So our federal government, the departments that fall under the president, add up to just as much as our entitlement programs, that is, Social Security and Medicare, and there is a lot of waste there. We need to go after that, but our politicians just can't seem to cut that. I mean, they don't want to cut it. We're talking $1.3 trillion a year is the federal government, and they can't even cut $4 billion. And, you know, the Democrats are trying to convince them that it's draconian if they cut any more than $10 billion. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of trying to take a surgical knife to this monster. I want to get a crash axe out and a chainsaw, and we're going to have to pare this beast down. But you're right. You're absolutely right. The size of the government has got to get smaller, and we've got to return sovereignty to the states. Let the states have the money. Let them deal with it. The federal government just doesn't do it right because it never was designed that way. Now, we've only got a few minutes left. We've got somebody else that just called in. It says unknown. I don't know where you're from. I'm going to bring you on. Caller number two, where are you calling from?
Fuck you.
Yeah, well, nice. People, there you go, is a typical liberal that says that Republicans and conservatives can't be civil. And what do? They call in, and all they do, they use profanity, and they have no substance. So if, sir, you were a liberal, I doubt you were a conservative because you probably would have the nice manners of Rick here. Nice 23-year-old young man, then you are a typical liberal. And you just made the case for anybody listening that might be in the middle, independent, that you liberals really are of no substance and you're rude and crude people. So thank you for confirming that for us and have a great day. All right, Rick, sorry you had to hear that. And if I had my call center here today, I'd have had to hear that at all. But that's... And you know what? The other thing is, when it came in, there was no caller ID. So the person obviously blocked their caller ID because they wouldn't want me to know where they are or who they are so I could actually call them back. And that's what liberals are. They tend to be cowards. So I'll throw that out there, and maybe we'll get some more liberals to call in since I've just kind of called them on the carpet for that. Let's see. Let me wrap this up. We've got about four more minutes here, and I quoted a few of the people that liberals hate to listen to. But one of the people that really was a centralized government guy and wanted the federal government to do more of us, and that's why he was a Federalist, and he was a very staunch Federalist. But before the Constitution was ratified and he was trying to convince the states that it was in their best interest, I think he became more of a Federalist afterwards, but he was trying to be a little more moderate. Alexander Hamilton said this about the enumerated powers of the legislature, and I bring this up because a gentleman, a friend of mine the other day said to me, well, Congress can pass any laws they want. I said, no, they can't, only if it's in the Constitution. Oh, no, they're elected to pass laws, and they can pass any laws they want. Well, they can't. The Tenth Amendment says they can only do what's in the Constitution, and they can't take what's in the Constitution and turn it into general terms. And here's what Alexander Hamilton, a Federalist, had to say about it in the Federalist Papers, number 83. He said, this specification of particulars, and he's talking about the 18 enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, evidently excludes all pretension to a general legislative authority. And that's what my friend was talking about, a general legislative authority. They can do whatever they want. Because an affirmative grant of special powers would be absurd as well as useless if a general authority was intended. So what he was saying is, why do we have these specific enumerated powers if a generalized power is what we intended? So another founder that was there, that worked with Madison on putting together the concepts for a constitution, and of course there he proves to us that our enumerated powers are exactly what the founders intended. Now the liberals then will throw that out, that, well, you've got to change with the times. And I'll throw this out. When it comes to the
I don't know if you can hear me, Tom, but we definitely can't hear you.